This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Depending on how you look at it, we're either one day after or 52 weeks before Election Day. Regular listeners know that we follow the campaigns, all the campaigns, every Wednesday with political editor Ken Rudin. And because of the intense interest in 2008, we're going to expand the Political Junkie segment for the next year. So this will be the place to talk with players and pundits to follow the money, calculate the spin, and try to answer a trivia question or two. And to inaugurate this new incarnation of the Political Junkie, a newly revised introductory montage.
There you go again.
My name is Geraldine Ferraro.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
I'm John Kerry, and I'm reporting for duty.
But I'm the decider.
In a few minutes, our main focus this week is the gender card. Did the other Democratic candidates gang up on Hillary Clinton? Were those unseemly attacks on a woman? Are they rough and tumble that any front runner should expect? We're in uncharted territory, so what are the rules for Hillary and what are the rules for her opponents? Our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Of course, there's a little bit of other news, too. Those elections yesterday. Pat Robertson endorses Rudy Giuliani, Dennis Kucinich's bill to impeach Vice President Cheney, a new one-day internet funding record, a new attorney general coming up, and the possibility of the president's first veto override. We have a new montage, but the same old political junkie Ken Rudin is with us here in Studio 3A.
And same old Neil. How are you, Neil?
I'm good. How are you? So our trivia question this week?
Well, we're going to be talking about women and a female candidate. So the first woman to get votes for the nomination, for the presidential nomination at the national convention.
That if you'd like to answer that trivia question, I can see the fingers racing to Google already.
The phones are off the hook.
That's it. Call us, 800-989-8255, or email us, talk@npr.org. We have a whole year, Ken, to talk about the 2008 races. Why don't we talk about 2007?
Well, I guess the Democrats got the bragging rights yesterday. There was two governorships at stake. We always knew that Haley Barbour in Mississippi was going to win re-election, so I guess the focus was on Kentucky now. I guess we always knew that the Democrats were going to take that as well. Ernie Fletcher was the first governor elected, first Republican elected governor in Kentucky since 1967. But almost from the beginning of his administration, he was in trouble. He was indicted for a short time for violating patronage rules, you know, and hiring practices. Some of the Republicans thought that this was a political indictment. But the point is that Ernie Fletcher was on the defensive with low voted numbers for most of his term. And it was a foregone conclusion that he would lose. And he did lose pretty convincingly yesterday. Steve Beshear, the former lieutenant governor, will return Kentucky to Democratic rule.
And those were the races, I guess, at the top of the tickets yesterday. But interesting statewide results in Virginia.
Well, that's actually very big. I mean, we always talk about how Virginia still continues to go Republican for president, but down ballot issues in Virginia, it seems to be turning a little shade of blue. The Democrats have won the governorship of Virginia the last two times. Democrats unseated George Allen last year in an upset in 2006. And, of course, they're looking at John Warner's seat next year with Mark Warner. But they also won control of the state Senate for the first time in a dozen years yesterday. They needed four state legislative seats, and they took all four. And while, you know, state legislatures usually are not that important, one, it does show a growing Democratic presence in Virginia. And of course, the state legislature will redraw congressional districts in 2010. And the state legislature, if it goes Democratic, the other chamber is still Republican, but if Democrats make inroads there, they could jeopardize some of the Republicans in Congress.
Several cities, Houston, San Francisco, and Pittsburgh, reelected their mayors. Philadelphia got a new one.
Right. Michael Nutter is a former city council member, like his predecessor, John Street. Nutter is African-American, of course, a Democrat. No Republican has been elected mayor of Philadelphia since the 1940s. But Nutter is far different than John Street. John Street was always under some kind of an ethics investigation, ethical cloud. The FBI had bugged his office. That was a big issue in his campaign 4 years ago. Nutter seems to be from a different cloth. But one of the campaign results that very few people are talking about, when Gavin Newsom was reelected mayor of San Francisco, of course, he being the person who had an affair with the wife of his campaign manager, which I guess didn't hurt him. But one of the candidates running against him was a guy named Grasshopper Kaplan. And to me, we need more candidates by the name of Grasshopper Kaplan.
So let's get to the main event, which is, of course...
I thought Grasshopper Kaplan was the main event.
No, that's 2008, presidential election. Okay. Right. Some interesting endorsements today, including this one for Rudy Giuliani here in Washington, D.C., from the Reverend Pat Robertson.
Today, I wish Rudy Giuliani success in the caucuses and primaries, which will take place in a few months. And beyond that, it is my hope and prayer that he will lead the Republican Party to victory in November of 2008. Congratulations,
Mr.
Mayor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pat Robertson, of course, ran for president himself once, thinks of himself at least as Mr. Christian Evangelical Conservative.
Exactly. When he ran for president in 88, I mean, it was Pat Robertson's campaign that brought all these religious evangelicals into the political spectrum. And of course, Rudy Giuliani being pro-choice and pro-gay rights, it's a startling endorsement. But the next thing you'll do, I mean, you never know, but you might even see Rudy Giuliani wearing a Red Sox cap. I mean,
it's kind of crazy.
But no, I mean, it's really, really remarkable. The thought. I mean, I don't know what endorsements mean anymore. At the same time, as you know, Sam Brownback, a former presidential candidate, endorsed John McCain today.
Now, that makes Christian more, conservative
exactly,
himself.
That makes more sense. Both are very strong on the pro-life issue. But the thought of Pat Robertson endorsing Rudy Giuliani is probably not going to be the last bizarre thing in this campaign season.
Our guest, of course, Ken Rudin. This is our expanded political junkie segment from now on until next election day. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. A little bit later, we'll focus on the gender card. Don't forget our trivia question. Who was the first female candidate to get votes on the convention floor in a presidential race? And, well, I think we have a proposed answerer. Chris joins us. Chris calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah, my guess would be Shirley Chisholm.
That was my guess, too. I was wrong.
Nope, not Shirley Chisholm. She did get votes at the 1972 Democratic Convention, but it was before Shirley Chisholm.
Thanks very much for the call, Chris.
Thank you.
Nice to have people who actually depend on their memories instead of their computers. Ron Paul, the maverick, I think is fair to say, a Republican candidate, a former Libertarian Party candidate for president, set a one-day fundraising record on the Internet.
$3.3 million. And you know something? First of all, we should talk about this in somewhat of depth here. I get emails all the time from people saying, why isn't NPR covering Ron Paul? Now, NPR is talking about Ron Paul. We have blog entries and we have pieces by our reporters and we have columns about it, written about him. But
Ron Paul's been on this show.
That's right. Exactly right. He called in. And of course, he was part of the half of the Beatles, you know, Ron Paul, George and Ringo. But the point is that he is raising a ton of money. That should make him a candidate that the media should really take a second look at. But at the same time, we keep also mentioning that he's not showing up in the polls. The question is whether his supporters will turn out in Republican caucuses and primaries. Now, if they do, then he's a force to be reckoned with. A lot of us think of Howard Dean, who was so popular on the blogosphere 4 years ago and ultimately went nowhere. Now, the comparison may not be apt, but the point is that Ron Paul is really startling to see the amount of money he's raised and the loyalty among his supporters on the web.
Speaking of people considered to be marginal candidates in their party races, Dennis Kucinich this week finally got the entire Congress to listen to his plea that they consider a bill to impeach Vice President Cheney.
Well, as soon as the Democrats took over the House last November, Speaker-to-be Nancy Pelosi said the impeachment of President Bush, Vice President Cheney, is off the table, so forget about it. But Kucinich and maybe about 20 other Democrats have been pushing this issue from the beginning, for the longest time, talking about, dishonest information about the decision to go to war in Iraq. And so he had a point of personal privilege, was able to bring this resolution to the floor of the House yesterday. Now, that's fine. And Steny Hoyer, the Democratic Majority Leader, immediately put up a motion to table or to
kill it.
Kill it, exactly, the resolution. And so, of course, everybody was voting to kill it until the Republicans realized, well, wait a second, why should we help Steny Hoyer put down a revolt by the left wing of the party, the Kucinich votes of the party? Why not vote to have this debate out in the open. So 165 Republicans voted for the Kucinich resolution, and it passed overwhelmingly. And of course, the Democrats were red-faced, and they accused the Republicans of playing politics.
Ultimate,
no. Yeah, well, you know, just, well, anyway. So anyway, so the ultimate end of it all was that another resolution came out, said, okay, we're going to refer this to the Judiciary Committee. Now, of course, it could be buried there, too, but the point is, John Conyers is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. He has sent some things about impeachment that could leave the Kucinich folks perhaps with an idea that maybe this will get some kind of consideration. But given the views of Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and the Democratic leadership, I suspect it's not going anywhere.
We have some more people weighing in on the trivia contest. Let's go to Anna. Anna's with us from Newton Square in Massachusetts.
Newtown Square in Pennsylvania.
All right. I would have gotten it right sooner or later.
I know you would. You always do. I believe it was Eleanor Roosevelt.
Did Eleanor Roosevelt get votes in the Democratic Convention? What have that been, 1948?
The date, I don't recall, but I know this is what I remember.
What about that, Ken?
Well, you know something, I mean, I hate to hedge, but I mean, it's very possible that, for example, in 1972, when George McGovern threw up, you know, had his vice presidential nomination, Mickey Mouse and Walt Disney got votes. I don't think the fact that Eleanor Roosevelt was never an actual candidate. I'm talking about an actual candidate
well,
for president who got convention votes at the convention for the nomination.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry about that.
Okay, but hey, a good guess.
Yeah.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Let's see if we can get an answer from Will. Will's with us from Cavendish in Vermont.
I think it's Margaret Chase Smith in 1964 in the Republican convention.
No, I'm sorry. The answer is it's Margaret Chase Smith at the 1964. Will's right. He is correct. Well, you're absolutely right. At the San Francisco convention that nominated Barry Goldwater, Margaret Chase Smith did get serious convention attention at that convention.
That was at the Cow Palace.
At the Cow Palace, exactly.
All
and
right.
When Nelson Rockefeller was booed off the stage because he criticized the John Birch Society.
And
we haven't talked about the John Birch Society much
in quite some time.
Yeah,
no,
we'll get the
Chad Mitchell Trio up here to sing about it. Will you get your no prize for getting the answer correct? Thanks very much for the call. It's a giant-sized edition of The Political Junkie. More with Ken Rudin in a moment. We'll get to the main subject this week. Did Hillary Clinton play the gender card? We'll get the rules for a fair fight next. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A little bit later in the hour, we'll get the full story on a study that finds a little extra weight can be a good thing. Stick around for that. As we mentioned earlier, for the next year, we're expanding the weekly Political Junkie segment as we approach the 2008 presidential election. What is it, 355 days away? Ken Rudin is with us, as always, NPR's political editor and our own political junkie. Our focus today is on Hillary Clinton and the gender card. Did the other Democratic candidates gang up on her, or was this just the rough and tumble any front runner should expect? 800-989-8255, or drop us an email, talk@npr.org. And Ken, set this up for us. The gloves had been on very largely through, the first half dozen Democratic debates.
Well, I don't know if the gloves have been on as much as the fact that Hillary Clinton has always acquitted herself so well in the debates, you know, respectable answers. Obama and John Edwards, all the other Democrats trying to lay a glove on her, could not. But it was really not the other candidates that messed up Hillary last Tuesday's debate at Drexel University in Philadelphia. It was Hillary Clinton's inability to give a straight answer towards the end of the debate as well. One about giving driver's license to illegal aliens, as New York Governor Eliot Spitzer has recommended, her decision about what to do about her private conversations with Bill Clinton, who she's very close with,
yes,
at the National Archives, Charlie Rangel's tax plan, Iran, Iraq, NAFTA. She has not given clear answers. And so the Democrats who were looking for, other Democrats looking for an opportunity to strike, had that opportunity. Obama, John Edwards, Chris Dodd, the other Democrats said, wait a second, you can't have it both ways. You can't give us Clinton-esque answers.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, the day after the campaign, Hillary campaign Hillary campaign ran an ad, talked about how these boys, the boys were ganging up on me. She went to Wellesley College, her alma mater, on Thursday, and talked about, again, how these mean guys pick on this poor little girl. Eventually, she came to her senses and realized this is not the way to go. The point is, probably the reason everybody's ganging up on her is because she has 20 to 30 point lead in national polls. And how else are you going to bring her down by except for attacking her? But then, interestingly enough, Bill Clinton on Monday in Las Vegas took it a step further, that he equated the attacks by Tim Russert and John Edwards and Barack Obama to what the Republicans did to Max Cleland in 2002.
And John Kerry.
And John Kerry, Swift voting in 2004. Many Democrats thought that was over the top.
Mm. Well, somebody who's now written an article about what the rules are in this uncharted territory. We've never had a woman presidential candidate being the front runner before. Libby Copeland wrote about that in this morning's Washington Post. On the flip side, she also considered the challenges for male candidates of running against a female opponent. Her article is called Rules for a Fair Fight. She joins us here today in Studio 3A. Thanks so much for coming in.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you ask an interesting question in your article. Is a woman candidate primarily a woman or a candidate?
Discuss.
Yes.
It is very difficult to separate the two. And, of course, there's this sense that Hillary is an exception in so many ways. So it's very hard to compare her to people who've been in this position before. We've never had sort of a front runner who has been so far ahead, who has so much money and so much celebrity status and happens to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
But we have had situations where things have played out in gubernatorial races and even on the presidential level. And it is very hard to separate the two.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who look at the scene of, for example, Hillary Clinton with all those guys on stage and also the moderators, and Tim Russert, for example, quote unquote, attacking her. And they see women in particular, I'm in a boardroom and I'm the only woman and I feel uncomfortable. That is the sort of visceral response of some people.
And some people you talked to said also protective of the woman candidate.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it is, in many ways, a kind of a Rorschach test. It's an inkblot. You look at it and you bring your own feelings to it. So that I had some people, Geraldine Ferraro, saying, you know, it was like she was a pinata for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then another Democratic strategist, Anita Dunn, saying, no, not at all. They were softer on her than she would have been had she been a male frontrunner. So the question is, can you separate it? And you really can. I mean, there's no control group, right?
Right.
It's not like we can go back and do it all over with Hillary Clinton being a man. So we don't know what would have happened, and that's what makes this so difficult to parse.
And one of the things you came up with was a different set of rules for women and men.
Yeah, and I don't want to...
These are not inscribed in stone.
Right, I don't want anyone to think I'm supporting these, but we sort of wanted to look back at some previous races and say, okay, so if we know that gender comes in this kind of a situation,
mm-hmm.
and that some people are going to see it this way, what are the other things that play out that women in particular have to do when they're running for particularly an executive position, executive office position? And, you know, one of the things is really kind of silly. One of the people I talked to said, we call it the trifecta: hair, hemlines, and husbands. And it's like, oh, God, do we have to go? But okay, fine.
Okay.
Manage the clothes. You do. I mean, you do have to. And if you look back at some of the things that Senator Clinton started wearing when she was first running for the Senate in 2000, dark pantsuits, she sort of took that question off the table.
The sexuality issue.
Well, and also the ability of the press in particular to devote column inches to how she is dressed on this particular day. If you deviate, then there's less space in that column for stances.
And also spoke out about the war in Iraq or whatever.
Right, right. Well, there was a woman political strategist that I spoke with who argued that part of the reason Hillary Clinton can be seen as being so hawkish on issues having to do with Iraq is because she had to out-masculine all the other guys. Because one of the biggest issues for women is toughness. They have to seem tough because that is their greatest weakness. Is they're seen as and Pat Schroeder, I believe it was. I'm sorry, it was Pat Schroeder was crying after she pulled mm-hmm. out. That was widely seen as something that had to do with perhaps her gender. You know, the AP ran a story saying she.
Same thing with Ed Muskie. I remember.
Right,
that.
Ed Muskie. Right, absolutely. But women, for example, see, you know, there are some cases in which they see it different. Geraldine Ferraro got the question on I think it was on Meet the Press in '84. Would she have the strength to push the button? And the question was always, would they have said that to a male candidate? And she interpreted it as questioning her toughness. This goes back again to the toughness argument. We won't know, but she does make the point that she hasn't heard of it being asked of male candidates for the presidency.
So we're asking callers to weigh in. What do you think? Did Hillary overplay the gender card? Should she be treated differently? Should we just have to accept this? What are the rules for a woman front runner and the other candidates in this unprecedented situation? 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Ken?
You know, I have this vision during the 2000 Senate race in New York where Rick Lazio, who was the Republican nominee against Hillary Clinton, had the temerity to walk over to Hillary and I think push something in some position papers in her face and had her comment on it.
It was a pledge. She wanted her to sign it. Yeah.
And everybody reacted, whoa, you're invading her space. And that was, again, how do you deal as a male candidate with a female candidate?
Right.
And we talked about also the clothing.
Can you attack?
And the clothing that's off there. But we also had this, I think it was the Washington Post, which a paper you're familiar with, spent too many column inches on Hillary Clinton's cleavage not too long ago.
Well, I thought that was a great article. And I'm not just saying that because I work there, but certainly that, you know, and that sort of played out in an interesting way because the campaign wound up sending out a note that was attached to a fundraising letter, sort of using it as a way to raise money. And people were upset about that article. But, you know, with the Lazio thing, it's interesting because I've gone back and talked to people and said, okay, what was your read on that? Because he brought her this pledge. It was to ban soft money.
It.
Hillary, why don't you sign it? Well, I don't know if you said Hillary, but why don't you sign it? And there were people who said he would never have done that to a man. He would never have invaded a man's space that way. Hmm. And other people saying, are you crazy? People do that in debates all the time. But either way, Lazio loses because even the people who say that it goes on in debates all the time, they recognize that it plays out differently when it's a woman. There's a sense perhaps of bullying, and there is perhaps an old-fashioned element to our culture where we still expect the guy to be somewhat chivalrous towards a female candidate. So how do you attack?
That was hardly the only problem with Rick Lazio's campaign. But let's see if we get some listeners involved in this conversation. Shireen joins us. Shireen calling us from Charleston, South Carolina.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show.
Thanks.
I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I consider myself a feminist too, but I think it's a little bit disingenuous of Hillary's campaign to use the gender card in this case. I think she's smart, she's capable, but she's the front runner, and I think that's why the other candidates were trying to distinguish themselves and their platforms and perspectives. I didn't see it as an attack. I watched that whole debate on MSNBC, and I kind of liken it to when Obama, I think it was the YouTube debate, was sort of attacked by the Hillary campaign and called naive and so forth. He didn't come back and say it's because he was a minority that he was being attacked.
That he was young.
Right. I think Hillary is smart. I just don't think that in this case, it's a wise move to claim gender was the reason she was.
And Ken, it's interesting. Shireen's got a point, of course. It's not just the Democrats who are attacking her as the front runners. It's the Republicans who attack her as the front runner.
Well,
too.
Actually, the way I've been hearing it sounds like the Republicans want her to be the front runner because, according to what they have to say, they would love to run against her. And there are not too few Democrats who agree that perhaps they fear that the Republicans would mostly like to run against her. And even John Edwards mentioned this at the debate because they feel she might be the easiest to beat.
All right. Shireen, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Susan. Susan with us from Bakersfield in California.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
My comment was that I couldn't imagine, after I heard what Hillary Clinton said the other day, I couldn't imagine having heard Margaret Thatcher or Golda Meir ever saying something like that. They were in that arena. They were heads of state, and I don't think they ever tried to play that card, and I was disappointed that Hillary Clinton played it.
Not to be picky, they were heads of government, not of state, but anyway, anybody who's ever been in a room with Margaret Thatcher knows that toughness was not an issue.
Correct.
Right. I mean, you know, this is what's so interesting, and this is, as far as I can tell, an argument that is being debated most vociferously by women. It is women who see her as having been attacked and women who see her as not having been attacked and as playing the gender card and who suggest that it's not a feminist thing to do, if you will, or not a strong woman thing to do to kind of pull that out and have that be an issue. If you notice how her campaign did it, it was very subtle. It wasn't direct. And she herself was never on record as saying anything along those lines. She herself said, well, they're attacking me because I'm a front runner, period, end of story. But what it was, what was going on in the sort of some of the coded language, if you will, as some people have seen it, that was being sent out by the campaign, that that people have interpreted as playing the gender card, so to speak, which has gotten us into this whole big debate about gender. And I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of this, because this is the very beginning of a truly exceptional, truly exceptional campaign with a woman at the front.
Our guest is Libby Copeland, a staff writer with The Washington Post, the author of today's article in the style section, Rules for a Fair Fight. Of course, Ken Rudin is also with us here in Studio 3A. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also weigh in on our blog. That's at npr.org/blog of the nation. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And let's go now to, this is Jennifer. Jennifer with us from Minneapolis.
Good afternoon. I was very disturbed by what I felt was Hillary Clinton playing the gender card, but I would say that nothing happens in her campaign without her explicit approval. She's that kind of a, it's come out in several books and articles about her that she's one of those kind of micromanagers. And even though she would never say herself that they were ganging up on her due to her gender, anything that showed up on her website, I mean, nothing, I think, happens in her campaign without her direction. So it's kind of...
Ken, is that an accurate observation?
Well, there's something to be said about that, and we always talk about the difference between Bill and Hillary Clinton. Whatever, as brilliant as Bill Clinton is, he was not the most organized campaigner in the world, and whereas Hillary Clinton is so to the letter. She has her hands on everything, and she's really on top of every issue like that.
Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can go now to Mike, and Mike's with us from Detroit.
Hi.
Hi.
It seems to me... I actually feel bad for her, because no matter what she does, if she doesn't laugh and acts somewhat normal, she gets criticized for being too severe. If she laughs, she gets criticized for cackling. It doesn't seem to matter what she does, she gets criticized for it. So I wonder why she thinks people are piling on.
Because she's the front runner, perhaps. But
I think you're right.
Libby Copeland, you had something about that laugh.
This is so, so true. And this goes back to the issue of, is she a woman or is she a candidate? And who can separate the two, right? I mean, we remember the flap about her laugh, the ha, 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 right, that she was doing, and how that was sort of poured over. And, you know, when I was in a conversation with Pat Schroeder the other day, she said, you know, how come people don't comment on the president's laugh? He sounds like Woody Woodpecker. And then she demonstrated, he, he. People have made fun of his laugh. Perhaps, I don't know that it's been perhaps as scrutinized on talk shows as her laugh was, but it's certainly been made fun of. But the point is that, you know, everything takes on a completely different cast when you're talking about, you know, Hillary Clinton and gender, and it's everything has this extra level to it.
You know what I was just struck by is that the women who have just called in to talk about the comment on this were all critical of Hillary Clinton playing the gender card. And we just heard from Mike, the first male we've heard from, who said, look, give Hillary a break. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mike, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Here's an email from Peggy in Arlington Heights, Illinois. Why is it okay for the media and most individuals to refer to Senator Clinton as Hillary? Mm. I've never heard anyone talk about John, Bill, or Barack without using their last names. I'm sure Mrs. Clinton is not afraid of any of the Johns, Bills, Rudys, or anyone else who will run against her. The gender issue does come into play, though, in terms of the way people refer to her. It's not respectful of her position to use her first name.
Let me give an answer, a quick answer to that. If you go to her website, if you talk to her campaign, it doesn't say Clinton. If you look at her posters, if you look at her buttons, they all say Hillary. So if anybody is starting this, it's the Hillary Clinton campaign itself. It's the first name. She's a first name candidate, and you'll see that throughout her whole website.
And part of that, I think, is to distinguish her from her husband, and part of that actually is an advantage that women have. There are women who have run on a first-name basis because there is sometimes perceived to be a closer personal connection to a female candidate, and so that they can kind of, and you'll see it on yard signs sometimes, they can capitalize on that by operating on a first-name basis. What's interesting is a lot of the subtle things that get said. I think there was a Bob Ehrlich, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend debate a couple years ago, and he kept calling her ma'am during the debate. Mm-hmm. That's an honorific that she did not particularly like, or at least that some female viewers felt was, and perhaps male viewers felt was, not the nicest. So you can really get into parsing the tiniest things. Is it ma'am? Is it a first name that can be seen as insulting, you know?
Jane, you ignorant slut. That would also be a bad thing. Right, right.
Jennifer was said to Jennifer Granholm, right? Was that, you know, Jennifer, there you go again.
So clearly those campaign signs, I should have read Meg for president.
I think there's truth about African-American candidates, too, because remember in 84 and 88 when Jesse Jackson ran, it was always, what does Jesse want? It's Jesse for president, right?
Mm. Yeah. All right. Thanks, both, you very much. Libby Copeland is a staff writer for The Washington Post, the author of today's piece in the style section, Rules for a Fair Fight. She joined us in Studio 3A. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
And
Thank
Ken
you.
Rudin, our political junkie, will be here every Wednesday for a new and expanded version of The Political Junkie. Thank you, Ken.
I can't wait.
And when we come back, we're going to be talking about one of those scientific studies you're going to want to hear about. Turns out, a little extra avoirdupois, not so bad. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.